Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. I want to start very briefly by saying I don't like to talk personally too often on the show, but I will tell you that I'm Jewish. My wife and kids are Jewish, and this has been a very rough couple of days in our family, as it has been for Jewish families across the country. And really, you don't have to be Jewish to have had a very difficult time the last couple of days. In the same way that you didn't have to be African-American, but you felt it more than others after the Mother Emanuel Church massacre, or any Muslim who has dealt with a violent hate crime in their community. And so we're going to start the show today by talking a bit about hatred in America and how we can look at getting past this awful, awful time in our lives. So I know it's not that we're not talking about campaign politics at the very top of the show. We will get to that because the election is going to go on. And we need to talk about what's happening in the final week of the election cycle. But let's get started by talking a bit about what happened in Pittsburgh on Saturday. We've got, of course, Jim Galloway here, the lead political writer for the AJC. Jim, thank you for being here. You and I traded messages on Saturday, and I appreciated the fact that you were aware of what a difficult day it was, especially for Jewish Americans.
Right, and anyone with a sense of history is going to be upset. And we'll get into the Atlanta's experience with this with the Temple bombing in a bit.
Yeah, we'll do that during the show as well. Jim, of course, appears in the Wednesday and Sunday newspaper and oversees the Political Insider blog at politicallygeorgia@myajc.com. Right across from him in the studio, Todd Rehm, Republican strategist, who's got a couple of candidates in this election cycle and who's spending the last week thinking about that. We're glad you're here today, Todd.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Bill.
And Howard Franklin, Democratic political strategist, is here as well. Hi, Howard.
Good afternoon, guys.
So let's talk a little. Jim, this... Oh, I didn't introduce Allison Padilla Goodman. See, this is why Galloway is a great sideman here. Allison Padilla Goodman is the Southeast Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League. And Allison, we're very glad you're here, even though I didn't introduce you from the very start.
Thanks, Bill. I'm happy to be here.
Allison, let's start with you, actually.
Sure.
First of all, why don't you explain to us, and to be transparent, I was the Southern Regional Director, Southeast Regional Director of ADL, the position that you hold now up until, I was there until about 5 years ago. You've been there almost a year, about a year?
About a year and a half.
Oh, it's that long. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you start by telling us, we're going to talk about the work you do in monitoring hate crimes, and I'd love you to start by just explaining what ADL's role is in all of this.
Sure. So ADL has been around for over 100 years. Our mission is to stop the defamation of the Jewish people and secure justice and fair treatment for all, which has been the mission since founding. We work on anti-Semitism, on hate crimes, on extremism, on anti-bias education. Saturday's events cut through almost every facet of what we do and was felt by every community that we touch. So we have 25 regional offices all over the country and one in Israel. And our regional office is in Pittsburgh, on the ground, organizing the vigils there, working with the community, helping with security. Our Center on Extremism is tracking and trying to find out more information and working with law enforcement on the ground. And then across the nation, we are working with communities on coming together and helping them work with their youth, work with their congregants, work with their coalition partners, work with their leaders on standing up and speaking out to hate.
So let me, before we talk about some of the information that you can share with us about hate crimes, let's personalize this a bit if we can. What was Saturday like for you and the people at ADL who you talked to that day from a personal point of view?
Gosh, Saturday was hard. It was hard for everyone. It was really hard for me, somebody who spends a lot of time in front of groups doing trainings about hate crimes, talking about the impact of hate crimes reverberating past the individual victims to the entire community who's left feeling fearful, isolated, angry, and sad. And that is how I felt on Saturday. It was hard to stop crying. It was hard to pull it together. Spent a lot of time snuggling on my children and animals and just kind of trying to recenter a little bit. Saturday really brought the work of ADL back to the front.
Why don't we listen to your boss, Jonathan Sure. Greenblatt, the national director of ADL, who was on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd yesterday. Chuck did the interview, and here's just a little bit of what Greenblatt had to say about Saturday.
We are living in a moment where anti-Semitism is almost becoming normalized, and that should shock and move all of us to act. So number one, we are seeing an environment in which anti-Semitism has moved from the margins into the mainstream as political candidates and people in public life now literally repeat the rhetoric of white supremacists. And they think it's normal and permissible to talk about Jewish conspiracies, manipulating events, or Jewish financiers somehow controlling activities. This isn't an issue of left-right, it's about right and wrong. And we should be able to speak truth to power whenever people in public life speak out with stereotypes and scapegoats that we know, as you were alluding to before, have been used for hundreds and thousands of years.
So let me bring in everybody on this. Greenblatt was very careful to not talk about President Trump, who is obviously being criticized by a great many people who believe that his rhetoric has set the stage for haters to thrive. He was very careful to say Democrats are guilty of inciting hostility and hatred. Republicans are as well. Jim, what's your take on that?
Well, number one, you have to point to the fact that Republicans are in charge of this country right now. They have the House, they have the Senate, they have the White House, and in times of crises, you know, you look to a national leader to walk you through this.
Okay, but my point. Go ahead.
But what I'm getting at is that broadly speaking, and again, not singling out any individual. We haven't, that's what's been missing from this conversation since Saturday, is just the adult figure, the father figure, if you will, getting up and saying, no, this won't do. It's very interesting that this is the last 3 years have been kind of an assault on political correctness, but political correctness was there for a reason. You know, it was there to set a standard by which we discuss the issues of the day. And there are places that political correctness, that there is language that you do not use. And that's what's been missing. We've taken down the guardrails.
Yeah, but again, I really don't want to point a finger at, say, necessarily Donald Trump, although we can talk in a little while about some of the rhetoric that's happened since Saturday. But Howard, I think Jim said an important thing. Where is the leader who is beyond partisanship, who is speaking out and is a respected, credible figure whose words count in this moment?
Yeah, at this point, that leader is absent. And it's not as if our president hasn't been given an opportunity to rise above the hyper-partisan environment we find ourselves in just a week before midterms elections. I think that's not, and I should say, in fairness and to your question, I do think there have been times, he's typically pointed it out and underscored it, but there have been times where President Trump has presented like the adult in the room, you know, stuck to a script, read from a teleprompter, understood the magnitude of the moment and presented accordingly. And for whatever reason, he chose not to be his better self yesterday. But to your question, I don't know how much I think it's just him. I think he obviously is at the tip of the spear. I think there are certainly plenty of others. And I'm reminded of you know, the sort of outburst we heard when President Obama was in the White House, before we ever heard of a potential President Trump, there are plenty of people in the public sphere who were doing things that were disrespectful beyond what we had seen before we had a black president.
All right. Todd Rehm, I want to get you into the conversation, but I don't want to get away too far from asking Allison to talk to us about what you have seen at ADL in terms of hate crime statistics in the last year or so. I think the headline is that ADL in 2017, the last full year of reporting, saw a remarkable spike in hate crime activity. Yes?
Yeah. So, while Saturday was shocking and horrifying, it wasn't necessarily that surprising. We've been talking a lot. ADL's been tracking anti-Semitic incidents for decades, and our 2017 data was pretty startling. In 2017, compared to 2016, we saw a 57% increase in anti-Semitic incidents from year to year. That's harassment, vandalism, assaults. That data gets even more disturbing when we dial down into some of the cohorts. So we saw a 94% increase on college campuses, and perhaps the hardest is an almost 90% increase in K-12 schools. Anti-Semitism is just everywhere. We've been seeing it and feeling it. And I think if you were to talk to pretty much any Jew, they'd be like, yeah, this is a part and it's something I feel all of the time. And that's what Jonathan Greenblatt was saying on Meet the Press, which I think is so important, is this mainstreaming of anti-Semitism and of this rhetoric. That's the piece that's really frightening and really scary. And that's the piece that we really need to push against. And where we need, you know, Howard was saying, and I agree, there are leaders all across the country at all levels. We need our student government presidents. We need our PTA presidents. We need the president of the United States to come out and speak out and say that this is not okay and this is not who we are.
So let's narrow it down a bit. You'd go state by state in the reporting.
Yep.
And any number of incidents happened in Georgia.
Yep.
We should be careful to make a distinction between the massacre that took place on Saturday at Tree of Life Synagogue and hate and incidents of hatred that take place on, as you say, almost routine basis. So in Georgia, as I looked at your report, we're talking about things like swastikas painted on a campus sidewalk in front of a Hillel, that sort of a thing. Real powerful messages of hatred against Jews, yes?
Yep. Correct. Yeah, we're not seeing, in 2017, we did not see a number of violent assaults against Jews. What we saw were huge spikes in the number of incidents around harassment and vandalism. These types of kind of everyday, easier actions that people can take that maybe don't take that extra step into violence.
Yeah.
Saturday
yeah.
was that violence.
Todd, you're a Emory alum, and Emory has, for a long, long time, been ground zero for a lot of this very kind of behavior. There's a strong Jewish presence on the campus, but over the years, there have been people who have targeted that Jewish student body with the kind of things Allison is talking about, swastikas, anti-Jewish messaging. So it's something you're pretty aware of, I think.
That's true, and I want to loop back to something you were
sure.
saying earlier about it was either you or Jim, I can't recall, about there being the adult in the room or the father figure talking us through this. I had that experience on Sunday, but I don't necessarily think that the government is the only place to look for moral leadership.
Yeah, I agree with that.
We heard Don Harp give a moving prayer coming out of retirement at Peachtree Road United Methodist Church, and that's where I look for moral leadership. The hyperpartisanship that Howard mentioned, this is something that is not just since 2016. It had been brewing for a number of years. I'm not saying it's President Obama's fault. I'm not saying it's President Trump's fault. I'm saying it's something that has built up over at least a decade. And we have all of us as political actors, whether we're just normal voters or whether we are consultants who may get carried away with the zeitgeist of what the people on the streets are talking about, we've all contributed to that. And we can all be part of changing that. But when Jim talks about political correctness as a set of sort of genteel rules under which we have our civic debate, I think that was true at one point. I think at some point in the 90s and accelerating through the last decade, the idea of political correctness and that there are words you can't say, there are sentiments you can't harbor inside your brain, even if not acted upon, has become a cudgel to use against people who believe differently. And again, that's not just a right-wing phenomenon. That's not just a left-wing phenomenon. It's something that a lot of people have done. It becomes easier to do it publicly now because you can do it publicly from behind a small screen or behind a larger screen at your desk. But we've all contributed it to it every time that we don't say, I'm not comfortable with that. I don't want to, you can't say that in front of me.
All right. So, I want to read. You said that we have to look for leaders who are outside of government. I think that's right. Greg Bluestein's rabbi posted or wrote a note that Greg put out on Twitter, and I retweeted on the Politics GPB site. And here's what his rabbi said. Our people have been targets of attacks for millennia. We have sought many ways to protect ourselves or fight back. We will continue to do so. Ultimately, our greatest response to those who seek to hate or destroy us and our greatest victory over them has been to refuse to submit to fear, but rather to continue to live, to learn, to pray, and to sustain our heritage. That is a response that is within the grasp of each of us today. Allison, your thoughts on what he said?
Yeah, I mean, we do need to kind of come together around this. And I should say, we have been really blessed to have received so many outpourings of solidarity from all communities in Atlanta. We've gotten beautiful messages from several churches, from the Islamic Speakers Bureau, from Planned Parenthood, from issues-based groups, you know, political, non-political, community members, past interns. People are just showing up right now, and that's exactly what they need to be doing.
If I could jump in and just kind of respond to what Todd was saying is, yeah, we government isn't the only source of leadership it's not the only source of leadership that we need right now, certainly, but we are living in a society that is more and more secular, and a society in which religious leadership, quite frankly, carries less and less weight within a community, and to me that makes it more important for political figures across the spectrum. I mean, you know, I want to hear from Nathan Deal. I want to see Nathan Deal in a pulpit talking about this. I want to see Johnny Isaacson in a pulpit talking about this. I want to see David Perdue. I want to see Michael Thurman.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And Howard, We have to give these. I do think there is just some synagogues that are now planning their services to remember what happened over the weekend. So there's time for these leaders that Jim's talking about to step forward, but they ought to.
Yeah, I totally agree. I went to Charleston after the massacre there a couple of years ago, and the broad array of leaders who saw fit to weigh in on this tragedy and weigh in on the troubled mind that was able to conceive, you know, killing people in a church, I think was useful to the discourse. So I wouldn't on this show promote any sort of false equivalence. I do want to talk more about kind of where Todd is on the all of us having a responsibility and a role for it, because I think there's also the prominence of backlash from people do speak out, right? It's such a chicken and an egg question. It's such a, you know, an unholy kind of revolving wheel, because I do think there are plenty of people, leaders, organizations who do try to speak out, and sometimes they get labeled as the political correctness police, or, you know, other things also may be thrown at them. So I'm really curious, and I think this is a difficult and a thorny question to answer, especially when you include the layer of politics in it.
Yeah, and we're going to go ahead, Todd.
I was going to say to Jim's point that the problem with lifting up our secular leaders as moral authorities in some way is that you eventually get to one who disagrees with you and is only accountable to a bare majority of the Electoral College. And so by saying that we're going to look to political leadership for moral guidance, you're empowering the next guy whom you may not agree with.
Todd, I hear that, except that's exactly what Trump does. He plays to his base and his base alone. So he will never be able to be a great uniter because his messaging is always to the people who supported him, and you know that. And part of the issue, it strikes me there, look, we've all accepted for some time now that it just isn't in his DNA to be a healer and a great moral a leader who can bring us together as a people. Ronald Reagan knew how to do it after Challenger. The Peggy Noonan speech that she wrote for him and he delivered so beautifully and with such feeling was an example of that. It had nothing to do with, you know, his playing to his base. You know, he talked about the astronauts who were killed in Challenger going off to touch the face of God. I mean, powerful. Barack Obama after Sandy Hook. I think Galloway's point is correct. So the trade-off, I believe, you get with President Trump is, for those who are supporters of his, is we're going to get our Supreme Court justices, we're going to get our conservative agenda. Okay, so he's not going to be the uniter. We accept that.
But I would say that when you cite that Reagan speech, the magic of that speech was not just that it was delivered by a very fine actor or that it was written by one of the preeminent wordsmiths of our lifetime. It's that it referred to eternal moral standards.
Right.
And that is something that has been, I would argue, drummed out of much of our civic discourse.
I'm frankly, you know, one of the things we know about the Anti-Defamation League is you are not a partisan organization. And so to some extent, I kind of want to wall you off from what is going to become, I think, a more partisan conversation after we finish a segment with you. So let's come back to you. You know, ADL marks all of these things. You monitor them. How do you fight back? You have programs like No Place for Hate. What are you doing to try to change the climate at ADL?
Sure. So we are engaging people in dialogue and discussion about difference in identity and how to stand up to bigotry and hate at all levels every single day. And with a number of different types of constituents. So No Place for Hate, we work in over 200 schools in the region, but thousands nationwide. We're touching millions of students across the country and teaching them how to speak up against hate when they see it happen. We have a really great resource online about empowering young people in the aftermath of hate that's actually for educators, students, or parents. So we can have these difficult discussions. We're working with law enforcement and training them on hate crimes and domestic extremism and how to respond and why communities need them to respond. And we're working in coalition with partners and advocates on protecting civil liberties and making sure that we all have kind of the equal rights and justice for all that we need and that our elected officials are helping to protect and promote that.
What did you make of Jim Galloway's suggestion that it is time for our leaders, for our elected leaders to come out and say words of consolation and unity?
Absolutely. I can tell you, as a member of the Jewish community and somebody who was affected, one of the first things I did was I went onto Twitter and looked at all of my electeds and saw their statements and who's felt good to me, right? We care. We care a lot about what our leaders are saying and doing. And again, it's all leaders. It's, you know, from our parents to our teachers to our cops on the street to our presidents. We need people to say out loud that this is not who we are. We are not white supremacists and anti-Semites and haters. This is not the mainstream. And America is more and better than this.
I just wholeheartedly agree. I think finding a reason to take political discourse out of this moral conversation is just it's somehow cheapening the discourse that we ought to be having. And I think it ought to be had across, you know, all the arrays that you've mentioned and plenty of others, right? And I think that there are plenty of the leaders that we look to today, you know, found their voice in moments of tragedy like these. And so I wouldn't for a moment, you know, want to live in a world where people of all walks of faith, of all stations of life, can't contribute to a moral conversation and help us figure out how we're going to get past it and how to heal.
So I'm looking at some of the responses we're getting on Facebook Live. Gerald King Carter sent to the Facebook community, how effective is the ADL? Rob Bryan said, if you have any interest in the Anti-Defamation League, follow them on Twitter. They have excellent posts. How effective is the ADL, Allison?
That's so nice. Thank you for promoting our Twitter feed.
The Facebook Live family here is really good.
people who go through our programs stay with us for a long, long time. And so we actually sent out something to all of our educators yesterday with a number of resources, and we're getting great feedback on some of that. The work is out there. The resources are out there. It's up to people to engage and to start changing their conversations in their days.
If you are a journalist and have ever had to cover extremist groups, the first thing you know to do is to call the ADL. My working with your group goes back to, is it Charles Wittenstein?
Yeah.
back in the, I would say, 80s, and Stu Lohengrin. These are the people who kept track of the clans of the Ed Fields, of the J.B. Stoners back in the day.
Yeah. All right. Let's do this. Allison Padilla Goodman, it was so lovely of you to come in. I know this is a very busy time for you. We wish you well with your work in the weeks ahead as you continue to combat hatred and bigotry. And again, not just in the Jewish community, but anyone who's dealing with hatred and bigotry. Thanks so much for being here.
I appreciate having me on. Thanks.
Let's do this. Let's take a break, and we'll come back in just a minute and continue with our conversation.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows. You're all sealed inside. Take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported this station, and well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Speaking of leaders, Todd Rehm just showed us a tweet that he had on his phone. Why don't you share it with us, Todd? You got your phone open there?
It takes me a second, but it was basically that Governor Nathan Deal has ordered flags flown at half staff until sunset on October 31st. In honor of the victims of the shooting.
All right. And, of course, the president did the same thing, issued an order for flags to be flown at half staff at government buildings. But okay. So, Jim, let's dig into this just a little bit more. The shootings took place on Saturday afternoon, of course, late Saturday morning, early afternoon. I'm not quite sure what that time frame was, but not long after that, the president was asked about the incident, and his first remarks had to do with they should have armed guards.
Right.
If they'd had an armed guard, it probably wouldn't have been as bad. He took a lot of immediate criticism for that remark, and maybe it was because it was the first thing out of his mouth. I will say, having been a longtime member of a Jewish community, armed guards do patrol at synagogues around Metro Atlanta, certainly on on Shabbat. So it isn't all that unusual. It just may have been the timing of his remark.
It may have the timing. I read a Washington Post report where the guy walked into a base, an unlocked basement door. That was the point of entry. So there may have been a security guard at the front door.
All right. Beyond that, though, you then have Trump having talked on prompter in the right way, the way you'd want a president to, with tweets like this. The fake news is doing everything in their power to blame Republicans, conservatives, and me for the division and hatred that has been going on for so long in our country. Actually, it is their fake and dishonest reporting which is causing problems far greater than they understand. He said there's, in a tweet just this morning, there's great anger in our country caused in part part by inaccurate and even fraudulent reporting of the news. The fake news media, the true enemy of the people, must stop the open and obvious hostility. And he goes on. He says if they give it up, to paraphrase, and then his quote, we will be able to bring sides together in peace and harmony. You know, Howard, I can be fairly agnostic in terms of picking sides, Democrat or Republican, in many cases. But this attack on the media, it infuriates me.
As it should. And in the one case, I think, in the discussion we're having today, we have seen congressional leaders come out and say, maybe without underscoring Trump's comments, but certainly say that the media is not the enemy of the people, that we rely upon the media to inform the electorate, to get messages out to the masses, et cetera. So I am encouraged. It seems like it's a one-man campaign against the media, and I don't know how long he plans to keep it up. I got to imagine that if the midterms don't go his way in one way or the other, we'll hear a lot about what the media has done and could have done to ensure the continuance of Republican majority. But I am encouraged that there are members of the Republican Party on prominent platforms who have shouted down this rhetoric and have disagreed with him publicly.
Todd, you're sort of in both worlds. You're a political consultant, but you also have your own a blog, georgiapundit.com. You work with the media all the time. Are you? What
he
happened?
He is the media.
He is the media. Well, he's yeah. All right. So, how do you defend the attempts of the president to somehow say we are the reason, or one of the reasons that Pittsburgh happened?
I will say this. I think that a lot of the problems that when people discuss issues they have with the media are really problems with guys in suits crunching numbers and not necessarily with individual journalists. Now, when the president does his Twitter thing, it often targets specific journalists. I do think that journalism and I should distinguish between journalism the way I consume it, which is primarily the written word, and what is increasingly passes for journalism, but is really more unscripted entertainment television, where we have seen a lot of the national outlets stop exercising journalistic discretion in some ways and simply ignoring stuff that's too stupid to really deal with in an intelligent way. But we've also seen a lot of what friends of mine, people I consider family, consider their news sources are really outrage machines that are designed to pluck the emotional strings of their viewers get them viewing, and it's almost like it's a feedback loop. You get outraged and you want more outrage because it feels so pure and so good. So you watch that stupid channel again where people are yelling at each other. And so, you know, there is a difference between journalism and the journalistic entertainment complex.
I grant you that, but Jim, we're the reason that there are such anger and hatred in this country.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what, there are two things that bothered me. Number one was that tweet that you read, and that there's an implied bargain there. You start saying nice things about me, the president was saying, and things will calm down.
Yeah.
The hatred will stop.
Yeah.
You do one, you get the other. I'm not sure, number one, that he's in control of that. So I'm not sure that it's something that we can even entertain. I will tell you what, the tweet that bothered me most on Saturday from the president was his decision to discuss the pitching shortcomings of the LA Dodgers.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, just.
Yeah,
I mean,
he tweeted out that they should not have pulled their starting pitcher for a reliever.
You're in one tweet. You are trying to at least making an attempt to convey some sympathy and empathy about what's happened in Pittsburgh, and then you're off to the World Series.
Well, I think the really ironic part of this entire display is that you've got a guy who essentially became a public figure by being an entertainer on television. And now he is complaining that he's not being taken seriously, although he does so many, you know, cartoonish things, whether it's on Twitter or behind the podium for a political rally. And I'm not saying that the president doesn't have the right, but I think in any, as a member of either party, you have to realize that the statements you're making have some consequence. People have the ability to weigh in and to give you and the broader public what they believe to be the substance or lack thereof when you're behind that microphone.
So in talking about how the president has dealt with this weekend for good and ill, I was thinking about, Jim, one of the worst acts of terrorism in the United States, which took place here. And I'm putting that in a historical perspective. At the time, it was one of the worst acts of terrorism. In October of 1958, the Hebrew Benevolent Association, the temple, one of the oldest Jewish congregations in the state of Georgia, was bombed. At 3 in the morning, I think there were like 20 pounds or something. Of 50 sticks of dynamite blew off a side of the building. Thank God no one was killed, but it shocked the Atlanta community at the time because it was such an overt and raging sign of hatred against Jews.
And it was, you know, I mean, this is if you're a movie buff, this is what Driving Miss Daisy was about.
That's
this
exactly was right. Daisy is coming to Temple to come to a service, and they pull up and stop. People remember the scene, and Hoke, the driver, says we can't go in. There's a bomb.
But it did two things. There were two things that to come out of that bombing. Number one is, I mean, it was all Rabbi Rothschild, who was leading the congregation at the time. I mean, he was already making a mark for himself as a proponent of desegregation, which in essence made the temple a target there. So it kind of illustrated the union of causes between religious freedom and racial justice.
Yes, and let me just play for a minute some sound from that morning, October 12th, 1958. Mayor William Hartsfield went immediately to the temple. He grabbed a WSB TV microphone and talked into their film camera and said this.
My friends, here you see the end result of bigotry and intolerance. And whether they like it or not, those who practice rabble-rousing and demagoguery are the godfathers of the cross-burners and the dynamiters.
So that was then-Mayor William Hartsfield of Atlanta. Tom Faust just told me that it's crossed the wires that President Trump is heading to Pittsburgh tomorrow. Bill Hartsfield wouldn't be a bad model for him for how to deal in the aftermath of this sort of thing, Todd.
I agree with that. I think that there is a place for measured statements like that. But again, I just don't pay that much attention to Washington. I don't pay that much attention to Twitter. Really, the last time I think I looked at Twitter on my cell phone was probably the last time I was here. And that's part of the discretion that I advocate is when people have turned a medium into a cesspit, well, get out of it. Quit swimming in it. It's done wonders for my peace of mind.
but Bill, if I could, in 58, when Hartsfield said that, he wasn't talking. I mean, he wasn't reacting to just little tidbits of social media. He wasn't responding to Twitter messages. He was responding to a very real political climate that actually had the upper hand in the South.
Yes.
I mean, you had we weren't too far removed from the days of Gene Talmadge, from the last lynching in Georgia, and it just. He was taking a very definitive risk. He was stepping out at that
point.
Yes,
he was. One of the remarkable things about this is that Leo Frank was lynched, the Jewish merchant who was convicted of murdering a young Marietta girl in his pencil factory. He was lynched. He was pulled out of the jail in Milledgeville, brought back to Marietta, and lynched. And the Jewish community in Atlanta started leaving in droves because they were terrified of what was happening around them, which is kind of the atmosphere that Jim was talking about. And one of the reasons that people were so afraid is that nobody came to their defense outside the Jewish community. Now, the beauty of the temple bombing was it was a bookend. In the aftermath of the temple bombing, in fact, led by William Hartsfield, the non-Jewish, the Christian community did come together and did offer their support to the people at the temple. So, in fact, Hartsfield was a forerunner for a movement that would take a very long time, Howard, before it came to real fruition. And some would say it may not have completely
not
come
fully,
to
fruition.
Yeah, but it was an incomplete bookend because they had five suspects in the case. Only one was tried twice, acquitted both times, and the cases were dropped.
Yes, but the point is that Hartsfield took a brave stand, not playing to his base.
That's right. I think you guys underscored it very, very well. I think taking a political risk and speaking to the moment in a way that was meaningful to a lot of folks, whether or not they were getting that message through multimedia, because Todd, I you know, I completely feel your pain as it relates to media. I guess my concern is just that people aren't leaving it, right? It's obviously got all sorts of issues. We talk about, and we've seen in the news, you know, leaders who have said things that have gotten booted from social media, et cetera. But it doesn't seem like the millions, if not billions, of people who are still using it to get their news or using it to spread their views are stepping back from the microphone or away from their computers.
But I can't control what they do.
Absolutely.
I can only control what I do, and I can only control what I suggest other folks do. I would say, to Jim's point about the chronology, we were also, it was also several years before Lester Maddox's rise to prominence. So it wasn't just like a stopping point, and now George is on the right track. But I think there's some level at which Hartsfield had been dealing with the underlying tensions, and I think that at that time, the racial issue was probably the greater of the racial tensions.
Well, and in fact, the great Rabbi or Jacob Rothschild, who was a great hero and civil rights leader in this town, was also the guy who, when Martin Luther King Jr. won the Nobel Peace Prize, and the rest of Atlanta, the business community, turned their back on him. It was Jacob Rothschild, his wife Janice, the Coca-Cola company, that came forward and said, "We are going to honor this man. This is an extraordinary achievement." And that, too, Howard, was a turning point in the business community's relationship to the African American community.
Absolutely. I mean that a storied narrative of retelling. And I mean, I back in 2011 went to Israel, and in many ways was reminded of all of the partnership that had grown from oppression, frankly, and from having each other's backs. And this is probably just further proof that Atlanta influences everything. So I'm glad to see we got some good examples here of the. Or examples of political and moral leadership that can be intertwined and still be very, very powerful.
I got to get another break in. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment.
Great question. That is a great question.
And that's a great question.
Wow, that's another great question.
That's a great question.
Oh, that's a great. That's a great question.
That is a great question.
What a great question.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear unexpected questions and unexpected answers.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB and streaming live at gpbnews.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Howard Franklin, Todd Rehm, Jim Galloway in the studio with me. We've been talking about the shootings in Pittsburgh and want to move on now to talk a little bit more about the political run-up to the election, which is just a little more than a week away. But a couple of notes. First of all, Tom Faust made sure I saw that the White House was very careful in its wording about where President Trump was going to be tomorrow. They did not. They said he was traveling to Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania. They did not say that he was traveling to Pittsburgh, according to Tom's reporting on this. That may be important because there's already been a movement in Pittsburgh to say to the president, please don't come here until you're ready to denounce white supremacy. So, Jim,
white nationalism is, I think, the phrase they used, and which, you know, and the president used half of that phrase at a rally last week.
Yes, talking about he's a nationalist. The other news that we should share with you, you've probably heard it already, there was another package, a bomb package, that was intercepted at a post office, this time in Atlanta. It was addressed to CNN in Atlanta, and the latest on that story is that FBI now says that that device bears many resemblances to the devices that Cesar Sadoc has now been arrested and charged with having sent to Trump's targets, the people who Trump has attacked in recent years. So that form of terrorism gets a little bit closer to home, Howard.
Totally agree. I think I heard a podcast this morning, and it talked about how much people can push off some of the cyberbullying and the mean remarks and the lack of civility that oftentimes we hear about on social media and on the internet, and that this latest episode is bringing the reality of that discourse right into the front doors of many people. I was in New York, actually going on to a television interview that got interrupted when the first packages or the first bombs were discovered. And I mean, I think the politicians that cut into our broadcast were the mayor and the governor and the police commissioner. I mean, what they had to say beyond keeping New Yorkers safe, I think, was exactly that, that this discourse that's moved from social and internet is very real in a place like New York, and obviously it's made its way to another southern capital in the city of Atlanta.
All right. We don't have as much time as we usually will to talk about the election campaigns themselves, but let's say a few things. First of all, we know that Mike Pence is going to be here on Thursday to campaign for Brian Kemp, Vice President, will be here.
On a tour through south rural Georgia.
In the heart of where Kemp wants those votes, the rural voters. Mm-hmm. And then we think the president is going to be in Macon on Sunday. To the best of my knowledge, that still hasn't been formally announced.
Right, right.
But it is expected. And you just saw an update on something else that's going to
right.
happen.
We have a visit from former President Barack Obama at the Forbes Arena on November 2nd.
Alma mater, Morehouse College. That's awesome.
November 6th. So Trump's supposed to be here the 4th, I think, Sunday the 4th, and now we're going to have Obama here
on Friday.
Interesting. Todd Remite voted. My wife and I went and voted. We live in DeKalb. We went to a polling place that was open for early voting. We got there at 8:30, and the line was already an hour long by when we got there. So we didn't have a lot of trouble voting, but it was crowded. We've now had well over something like 1.1 or 1.2 million Georgians have voted in advance, and that's out of 6.9 million registered. That's pretty remarkable.
It's huge, and it underscores for me the wisdom of waiting until Election Day to vote. I usually go between 10 and 11 in the morning, and I can't remember ever having waited. I have the same routine every Election Day. With variations after I vote, but I always vote at the same time, and there's never a line. But it's really interesting that you know, I've been looking at the partisan and racial makeup of early voters for the last week, and Howard and I could argue from here until next Thursday about what
just till Tuesday
or Wednesday morning
what the different statistics mean. But I can tell you that as a professional campaign consultant, it has changed the way that we look at it. It used to be that everything built up to one single day, and now it's you're running that marathon every day for 3 weeks in a row. And I would not be too sorry to see us trim it back to maybe 2 weeks at some point in the future.
Well, the thing I would make mention of, we may be living through the very first election where we have more votes cast through absentee vote by mail and early voting than we actually see on Election Day, which I think is amazing. For both the convenience factor, but also to the point Todd is making, you know, this is a very dynamic political environment. Things are changing. There are developments. There are accusations. And the idea that more than half of the electorate will choose before Election Day says a whole lot about how politicking has to change and how politicians will also have to change.
It also means last-minute details don't matter nearly as much.
Not nearly as much. You're right.
Daniel Eason on Facebook Live has an interesting comment, Jim. He says, how does Mike Pence, who expanded Medicaid in Indiana, which Stacey Abrams talks about all the time, go about campaigning for a guy whose biggest issue is not expanding Medicaid in the state?
Well, I guess if the answer to that is Mike Pence, if really pinned down on that, he said, well, we cut a custom deal with the feds.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay. We are really running short on time on the show today. And the reason I wanted to mention the Medicaid expansion is we're heading to Savannah early tomorrow morning. We're going to be doing our 2 o'clock live show out of our Savannah Bureau, and we're going to dedicate a good portion of that show to doing a deep dive on healthcare and how it's playing in this election. Andy Miller of Georgia Health News, one of the great experts on this subject, will be with us. Kyle Haynes is in Washington, and he works on healthcare issues for the think tank he is part of. Tamar Hallerman is going to talk to us about her perspective on how healthcare is playing in Congress. So if you really want to learn as much as possible, and I certainly want to learn more about how healthcare plays into this election, I hope you'll join us tomorrow for that show. Kevin Riley, your boss, will be here as well, Jim.
All right.
Yeah.
He'll say wise things.
Yeah, of course he will. Then tomorrow night, we are looking forward to seeing an awful lot of you in Savannah. We're going to be taping our show at 7 o'clock, and I know a lot of you have already signed up. I think it's probably too late to register now, but you could go to gpb.org/community. Maybe there's a chance for you to reserve a seat for the show, but we'll be down there. Eric Johnson is going to be there, former state senator. Al Scott, chairman of the of Chatham County, will be with us. Susan Catron, the editor of the Savannah News. And Jim Galloway's a little under the weather. We hope you're feeling okay to make that trip.
I'm pumping DayQuil into my body right now.
All right. That sounds great. The other quick note is that we're going to be with you on election night. We're going to start at 7 p.m. on GPB television. We're going to do an hour show as the polls close. And then we're going to walk over to the radio studios, and starting at 8, we'll do local cut-ins to NPR's network coverage. We'll be on quite a bit throughout each hour to tell you what's happening in the elections here, and we'll have some of our top insiders here to help us break down how the election is shaping up. So, very, very big week coming up at GPB. Thank you so much for being with us today. I look forward to seeing you all in Savannah tomorrow. Take care.